kindly ascertained for me, vary greatly in thickness, being, on an average of 12 measurements made near the border of the comb, 1/352 of an inch in thickness, whereas the basal rhomboidal plates are thicker, nearly in proportion of 3 to 2, having a mean thickness from 21 measurements of 1/229 of an inch. By the above singular manner of building, strength is continually given to the comb with the utmost ultimate economy of wax. It seems at first to add to the difficulty of understanding how the cells are made that a multitude of bees all work together. One bee, after working a short time at one cell, going to another, so that, as Uwe has stated, a score of individuals work even at the commencement of the first cell. I was able practically to show this fact by covering the edges of the hexagonal walls of a single cell, or the extreme margin of the circumferential rim of a growing comb, with an extremely thin layer of melted vermilion wax. And I invariably found that the colour was most delicately diffused by the bees, as delicately as a painter could have done it with his brush, by atoms of the coloured wax having been taken from the spot on which it had been placed and worked into the growing edges of the cells all round. The work of construction seems to be a sort of balance struck between many bees, all instinctively standing at the same relative distance from each other, all trying to sweep equal spheres, and then building up, or leaving ungnawed, the planes of intersection between these spheres. It was really curious to note in cases of difficulty, as when two pieces of comb met at an angle, how often the bees would pull down and rebuild in different ways the same cell, sometimes recurring to a shape which they had at first rejected. When bees have a place on which they can stand in their proper positions for working, for instance on a slip of wood placed directly under the middle of a comb growing downwards, so that the comb has to be built over one face of the slip, in this case the bees can lay the foundations of one wall of a new hexagon in its strictly proper place, projecting beyond the other completed cells. It suffices that the bees should be enabled to stand at their proper relative distances from each other and from the walls of the last completed cells, and then, by striking imaginary spheres, they can build up a wall intermediate between two adjoining spheres. But as far as I have seen, they never gnaw away and finish off the angles of a cell till a large part of both that cell and of the adjoining cells has been built. This capacity in bees of laying down, under certain circumstances, a rough wall in its proper place between two just commenced cells is important, as it bears on a fact which seems at first subversive of the foregoing theory, namely that the cells on the extreme margin of wasp combs are sometimes strictly hexagonal. But I have not space here to enter on this subject. Nor does there seem to me any great difficulty in a single insect, as in the case of a queen wasp, making hexagonal cells, if she were to work alternately on the inside and outside of two or three cells commenced at the same time, always standing at the proper relative distance from the parts of the cells just begun, sweeping spheres or cylinders, and building up intermediate planes. As natural selection acts only by the accumulation of slight modifications of structure or instinct, each profitable to the individual under its conditions of life, it may reasonably be asked how a long and graduated succession of modified architectural instincts, all tending towards the present perfect plan of construction, could have profited the progenitors of the hive bee. I think the answer is not difficult. Cells constructed like those of the bee or the wasp gain in strength and save much in labour and space and in the materials of which they are constructed. With respect to the formation of wax, it is known that bees are often hard-pressed to get sufficient nectar, and I am informed by Mr. Tegetmeier that it has been experimentally proved that from 12 to 15 pounds of dry sugar are consumed by a hive of bees for the secretion of a pound of wax, so that a prodigious quantity of fluid nectar must be collected and consumed by the bees in a hive for the secretion of the wax necessary for the construction of their combs. Moreover, many bees have to remain idle for many days during the process of secretion. A large store of honey is indispensable to support a large stock of bees during the winter, and the security of the hive is known mainly to depend on a large number of bees being supported. Hence the saving of wax by largely saving honey and the time consumed in collecting the honey must be an important element of success to any family of bees. Of course, the success of the species may be dependent on the number of its enemies, or parasites, or on quite distinct causes, and so be altogether independent of the quantity of honey which the bees can collect. But let us suppose that this latter circumstance determined, as it probably often has determined, whether a bee allied to our humble bees could exist in large numbers in any country. And let us further suppose that the community lived through the winter and consequently required a store of honey. There can in this case be no doubt that it would be an advantage to our imaginary humble bee if a slight modification of her instincts led her to make her waxen cells near together so as to intersect a little, for a wall in common, even to two adjoining cells, would save some little labour and wax. Hence it would continually be more and more advantageous to our humble bees if they were to make their cells more and more regular, nearer together, and aggregated into a mass, like the cells of the Melipona. But in this case a large part of the bounding surface of each cell would serve to bound the adjoining cells, and much labour and wax would be saved. Again, from the same cause, it would be advantageous to the Melipona if she were to make her cells closer together and more regular in every way than at present. For then, as we have seen, the spherical surfaces would wholly disappear and be replaced by plane surfaces, and the Melipona would make a comb as perfect as that of the hive bee. Beyond this stage of perfection in architecture, natural selection could not lead, for the comb of the hive bee, as far as we can see, is absolutely perfect in economizing labour and wax. Thus, as I believe, the most wonderful of all known instincts, that of the hive bee, can be explained by natural selection having taken advantage of numerous successive slight modifications of simpler instincts. Natural selection having by slow degrees more and more perfectly led the bees to sweep equal spheres at a given distance from each other in a double layer, and to build up and excavate the wax along the planes of intersection. The bees, of course, are no more knowing that they swept their spheres at one particular distance from each other than they know what are the several angles of the hexagonal prisms and of the basal rhombic plates. The motive power of the process of natural selection having been the construction of cells of due strength and of the proper size and shape for the larvae, this being effected with the greatest possible economy of labour and wax. That individual swarm which thus made the best cells with least labour and least waste of honey in the secretion of wax, having succeeded best, and having transmitted their newly acquired economical instincts to new swarms, which in their turn will have had the best chance of succeeding in the struggle for existence. Objections to the theory of natural selection as applied to instincts, neuter and sterile insects. It has been objected to the foregoing view of the origin of instincts that the variations of structure and of instinct must have been simultaneous and accurately adjusted to each other, as a modification in the one without an immediate corresponding change in the other would have been fatal. The force of this objection rests entirely on the assumption that the changes in the instincts and structure are abrupt. To take, as an illustration, the case of the larger titmouse, Parus major, alluded to in a previous chapter. This bird often holds the seeds of the yew between its feet on a branch and hammers with its beak till it gets at the kernel. Now what special difficulty would there be in natural selection preserving all the slight individual variations in the shape of the beak which were better and better adapted to break open the seeds, until a beak was formed as well constructed for this purpose as that of a nuthatch, at the same time that habit or compulsion or spontaneous variations of taste led the bird to become more and more of a seed-eater. In this case, the beak is supposed to be slowly modified by natural selection, subsequently to, but in accordance with, slowly changing habits or taste. but let the feet of the titmouse vary and grow larger from correlation with the beak, or from any other unknown cause, and it is not improbable that such larger feet would lead the bird to climb more and more until it acquired the remarkable climbing instinct and power of the nuthatch. In this case, a gradual change of structure is supposed to lead to changed instinctive habits. To take one more case, few instincts are more remarkable than that which leads the swift of the eastern islands to make its nest wholly of inspissated saliva. Some birds build their nests of mud, believed to be moistened with saliva, and one of the swifts of North America makes its nest, as I have seen, of sticks agglutinated with saliva, and even with flakes of this substance. Is it then very improbable that the natural selection of individual swifts, which secreted more and more saliva, should at last produce a species with instincts leading it to neglect other materials and to make its nest exclusively of inspissated saliva? And so in other cases. It must, however, be admitted that in many instances we cannot conjecture whether it was instinct or structure which first varied. No doubt many instincts of very difficult explanation could be opposed to the theory of natural selection. Cases in which we cannot see how an instinct could have originated. Cases in which no intermediate gradations are known to exist. Cases of instincts of such trifling importance that they could hardly have been acted on by natural selection. Cases of instincts almost identically the same in animals so remote in the scale of nature that we cannot account for their similarity by inheritance from a common progenitor, and consequently must believe that they were independently acquired through natural selection. I will not here enter on these several cases, but will confine myself to one special difficulty which at first appeared to me insuperable and actually fatal to the whole theory. I allude to the neuters or sterile females in insect communities. For these neuters often differ widely in instinct and in structure from both the males and fertile females, and yet from being sterile, they cannot propagate their kind. The subject well deserves to be discussed at great length, but I will here take only a single case, that of working or sterile ants. How the workers have been rendered sterile is a difficulty, but not much greater than that of any other striking modification of structure. For it can be shown that some insects and other articulate animals in a state of nature occasionally become sterile. And if such insects had been social, and it had been profitable to the community that a number should have been annually born capable of work but incapable of procreation, I can see no especial difficulty in this having been effected through natural selection. But I must pass over this preliminary difficulty. The great difficulty lies in the working ants differing widely from both the males and the fertile females in structure, as in the shape of the thorax, and in being destitute of wings and sometimes of eyes, and in instinct. As far as instinct alone is concerned, the wonderful difference in this respect between the workers and the perfect females would have been better exemplified by the hive bee. If a working ant or other neuter insect had been an ordinary animal, I should have unhesitatingly assumed that all its characters had been slowly acquired through natural selection, namely by individuals having been born with slight profitable modifications, which were inherited by the offspring, and that these again varied and again were selected, and so onwards. But with the working ant we have an insect differing greatly from its parents, yet absolutely sterile, so that it could never have transmitted successively acquired modifications of structure or instinct to its progeny. It may well be asked, how is it possible to reconcile this case with the theory of natural selection? First, let it be remembered that we have innumerable instances, both in our domestic productions and in those in a state of nature, of all sorts of differences of inherited structure which are correlated with certain ages and with either sex. We have differences correlated not only with one sex, but with that short period when the reproductive system is active, as in the nuptial plumage of many birds, and in the hooked jaws of the male salmon. We have even slight differences in the horns of different breeds of cattle in relation to an artificially imperfect state of the male sex. For oxen of certain breeds have longer horns than the oxen of other breeds, relatively to the length of the horns in both the bulls and cows of these same breeds. Hence I can see no great difficulty in any character becoming correlated with the sterile condition of certain members of insect communities. The difficulty lies in understanding how such correlated modifications of structure could have been slowly accumulated by natural selection. This difficulty, though appearing insuperable, is lessened, or as I believe disappears, when it is remembered that selection may be applied to the family as well as to the individual, and may thus gain the desired end. Breeders of cattle wish the flesh and fat to be well marbled together. An animal thus characterized has been slaughtered, but the breeder has gone with confidence to the same stock and has succeeded. Such faith may be placed in the power of selection that a breed of cattle always yielding oxen with extraordinarily long horns could, it is probable, be formed by carefully watching which individual bulls and cows, when matched, produced oxen with the longest horns. And yet no one ox would ever have propagated its kind. Here is a better and real illustration. According to Monsieur Verlo, some varieties of the double annual stock, from having been long and carefully selected to the right degree, always produce a large proportion of seedlings bearing double and quite sterile flowers. But they likewise yield some single and fertile plants. These latter, by which alone the variety can be propagated, may be compared with the fertile male and female ants, and the double sterile plants with the neuters of the same community. As with the varieties of the stock, so with social insects, selection has been applied to the family, and not to the individual, for the sake of gaining a serviceable end. Hence we may conclude that slight modifications of structure or of instinct, correlated with the sterile condition of certain members of the community, have proved advantageous. Consequently, the fertile males and females have flourished, and transmitted to their fertile offspring a tendency to produce sterile members with the same modifications. This process must have been repeated many times, until that prodigious amount of difference between the fertile and sterile females of the same species has been produced, which we see in many social insects. But we have not as yet touched on the acme of the difficulty. Namely, the fact that the neuters of several ants differ not only from the fertile females and males, but from each other, sometimes to an almost incredible degree, and are thus divided into two or even three castes. The castes, moreover, do not generally graduate into each other, but are perfectly well defined, being as distinct from each other as are any two species of the same genus, or rather, as any two genera of the same family. Thus, in Eceton there are working and soldier neuters, with jaws and instincts extraordinarily different. In Cryptoceras, the workers of one caste alone carry a wonderful sort of shield on their heads, the use of which is quite unknown. In the Mexican Myrmecocytus, the workers of one caste never leave the nest. They are fed by the workers of another caste, and they have an enormously developed abdomen, which secretes a sort of honey, supplying the place of that excreted by the aphides, or the domestic cattle, as they may be called, which our European ants guard and imprison. It will indeed be thought that I have an overweening confidence in the principle of natural selection, when I do not admit that such wonderful and well-established facts at once annihilate the theory. In the simpler case of neuter insects all of one caste, which, as I believe, have been rendered different from the fertile males and females through natural selection, we may conclude from the analogy of ordinary variations that the successive slight profitable modifications did not first arise in all the neuters in the same nest, but in some few alone, and that by the survival of the communities with females which produced most neuters having the advantageous modification, all the neuters ultimately came to be thus characterized. According to this view, we ought occasionally to find in the same nest neuter insects presenting gradations of structure. And this we do find, even not rarely, considering how few neuter insects out of Europe have been carefully examined. Mr. F. Smith has shown that the neuters of several British ants differ surprisingly from each other in size, and sometimes in colour, and that the extreme forms can be linked together by individuals taken out of the same nest. I have myself compared perfect gradations of this kind. It sometimes happens that the larger or the smaller-sized workers are the most numerous, or that both large and small are numerous, while those of an intermediate size are scanty in numbers. For Mica Flava has larger and smaller workers, with some few of intermediate size. And in this species, as Mr. F. Smith has observed, the larger workers have simple eyes, ocelli, which, though small, can be plainly distinguished, whereas the smaller workers have their ocelli rudimentary. Having carefully dissected several specimens of these workers, I can affirm that the eyes are far more rudimentary in the smaller workers than can be accounted for merely by their proportionately lesser size. And I fully believe, though I dare not assert so positively, that the workers of intermediate size have their ocelli in an exactly intermediate condition. So that here we have two bodies of sterile workers in the same nest, differing not only in size but in their organs of vision, yet connected by some few members in an intermediate condition. I may digress by adding that if the smaller workers had been the most useful to the community, and those males and females had been continually selected which produced more and more of the smaller workers, until all the workers were in this condition, we should then have had a species of ant with neuters in nearly the same condition as those of Mimica. For the workers of Mimica have not even rudiments of ocelli, though the male and female ants of this genus have well-developed ocelli. I may give one other case. So confidently did I expect occasionally to find gradations of important structures between the different castes of neuters in the same species, that I gladly availed myself of Mr. F. Smith's offer of numerous specimens from the same nest of the driver ant, Anoma, of West Africa. The reader will perhaps best appreciate the amount of difference in these workers by my giving not the actual measurements, but a strictly accurate illustration. The difference was the same as if we were to see a set of workmen building a house of whom many were 5 feet 4 inches high, and many 16 feet high. But we must, in addition, suppose that the larger workmen had heads 4 instead of 3 times as big as those of the smaller men, and jaws nearly 5 times as big. The jaws, moreover, of the working ants of the several sizes differed wonderfully in shape, and in the form and number of the teeth. But the important fact for us is that, though the workers can be grouped into castes of different sizes, yet they graduate insensibly into each other, as does the widely different structure of their jaws. I speak confidently on this latter point, as Sir J. Lubbock made drawings for me with the camera lucida of the jaws which I dissected from the workers of the several sizes. Mr. Bates, in his interesting Naturalist on the Amazons, has described analogous cases. With these facts before me, I believe that natural selection, by acting on the fertile ants or parents, could form a species which should regularly produce neuters, all of large size with one form of jaw, or all of small size with widely different jaws, or lastly, and this is the greatest difficulty, one set of workers of one size and structure, and simultaneously another set of workers of a different size and structure, a graduated series having first been formed, as in the case of the driver ant, and then the extreme forms having been produced in greater and greater numbers through the survival of the parents which generated them, until none with an intermediate structure were produced. An analogous explanation has been given by Mr. Wallace of the equally complex case of certain Malayan butterflies regularly appearing under 2 or even 3 distinct female forms, and by Fritz Müller of certain Brazilian crustaceans likewise appearing under 2 widely distinct male forms. But this subject need not here be discussed. I have now explained how, I believe, the wonderful fact of 2 distinctly defined castes of sterile workers existing in the same nest, both widely different from each other and from their parents, has originated. We can see how useful their production may have been to a social community of ants, on the same principle that the division of labour is useful to civilised man. Ants, however, work by inherited instincts, and by inherited organs or tools, while man works by acquired knowledge and manufactured instruments. But I must confess that with all my faith in natural selection, I should never have anticipated that this principle could have been efficient in so high a degree had not the case of these neuter insects led me to this conclusion. I have therefore discussed this case, at some little but wholly insufficient length, in order to show the power of natural selection, and likewise because this is by far the most serious special difficulty which my theory has encountered. The case also is very interesting, as it proves that with animals, as with plants, any amount of modification may be effected by the accumulation of numerous slight spontaneous variations which are in any way profitable, without exercise or habit having been brought into play. For peculiar habits, confined to the workers of sterile females, however long they might be followed, could not possibly affect the males and fertile females, which alone leave descendants. I am surprised that no one has advanced this demonstrative case of neuter insects against the well-known doctrine of inherited habit as advanced by Lamarck. Summary. I have endeavoured in this chapter briefly to show that the mental qualities of our domestic animals vary, and that the variations are inherited. Still more briefly, I have attempted to show that instincts vary slightly in a state of nature. No one will dispute that instincts are of the highest importance to each animal. Therefore, there is no real difficulty under changing conditions of life in natural selection accumulating to any extent slight modifications of instinct which are in any way useful. In many cases, habit or use and disuse have probably come into play. I do not pretend that the facts given in this chapter strengthen in any great degree my theory, but none of the cases of difficulty, to the best of my judgment, annihilate it. On the other hand, the fact that instincts are not always absolutely perfect and are liable to mistakes, that no instinct can be shown to have been produced for the good of other animals, though animals take advantage of the instincts of others, that the canon in natural history of natura non facit saltum is applicable to instincts as well as to corporeal structure, and is plainly explicable on the foregoing views, but is otherwise inexplicable, all tend to corroborate the theory of natural selection. This theory is also strengthened by some few other facts in regard to instincts. As by that common case of closely allied but distinct species, when inhabiting distant parts of the world and living under considerably different conditions of life, yet often retaining nearly the same instincts. For instance, we can understand, on the principle of inheritance, how it is that the thrush of tropical South America lines its nest with mud in the same peculiar manner as does our British thrush. How it is that the hornbills of Africa and India have the same extraordinary instinct of plastering up and imprisoning the females in a hole in a tree, with only a small hole left in the plaster through which the males feed them and their young when hatched. How it is that the male wrens, troglodytes of North America, build cock nests to roost in, like the males of our kitty wrens, a habit wholly unlike that of any other known bird. Finally, it may not be a logical deduction, but to my imagination it is far more satisfactory to look at such instincts as the young cuckoo ejecting its foster brothers, ants making slaves, the larvae of Ichneumonidae feeding within the live bodies of caterpillars, not as specially endowed or created instincts, but as small consequences of one general law leading to the advancement of all organic beings, namely, multiply, vary, let the strongest live, and the weakest die. Chapter 9. Hybridism. The view commonly entertained by naturalists is that species, when intercrossed, have been specially endowed with sterility in order to prevent their confusion. This view certainly seems at first highly probable, for species living together could hardly have been kept distinct had they been capable of freely crossing. The subject is in many ways important for us, more especially as the sterility of species when first crossed, and that of their hybrid offspring, cannot have been acquired, as I shall show, by the preservation of successive profitable degrees of sterility. It is an incidental result of differences in the reproductive systems of the parent species. In treating this subject, two classes of facts, to a large extent fundamentally different, have generally been confounded, namely the sterility of species when first crossed, and the sterility of the hybrids produced from them. Pure species have, of course, their organs of reproduction in a perfect condition, yet when intercrossed they produce either few or no offspring. Hybrids, on the other hand, have their reproductive organs functionally impotent, as may be clearly seen in the state of the male element in both plants and animals, though the formative organs themselves are perfect in structure, as far as the microscope reveals. In the first case, the two sexual elements which go to form the embryo are perfect. In the second case, they are either not at all developed or are imperfectly developed. This distinction is important when the cause of the sterility, which is common to the two cases, has to be considered. The distinction probably has been slurred over, owing to the sterility in both cases being looked on as a special endowment beyond the province of our reasoning powers. The fertility of varieties, that is, of the forms known or believed to be descended from common parents, when crossed, and likewise the fertility of their mongrel offspring is, with reference to my theory, of equal importance with the sterility of species, for it seems to make a broad and clear distinction between varieties and species. Degrees of sterility. First, for the sterility of species when crossed and of their hybrid offspring. It is impossible to study the several memoirs and works of those two conscientious and admirable observers, Kohlreuther and Gartner, who almost devoted their lives to this subject, without being deeply impressed with the high generality of some degree of sterility. Kohlreuther makes the rule universal, but then he cuts the knot, for in 10 cases in which he found two forms considered by most authors as distinct species, quite fertile together, he unhesitatingly ranks them as varieties. Gartner also makes the rule equally universal, and he disputes the entire fertility of Kohlreuther's 10 cases. But in these, and in many other cases, Gartner is obliged carefully to count the seeds in order to show that there is any degree of sterility. He always compares the maximum number of seeds produced by two species when first crossed, and the maximum produced by their hybrid offspring, with the average number produced by both pure parent species in a state of nature. But causes of serious error here intervene. A plant to be hybridized must be castrated, and what is often more important, must be secluded in order to prevent pollen being brought to it by insects from other plants. Nearly all the plants experimented on by Gartner were potted and were kept in a chamber in his house. That these processes are often injurious to the fertility of a plant cannot be doubted, for Gartner gives in his table about a score of cases of plants which he castrated and artificially fertilized with their own pollen, and excluding all cases such as the leguminosae, in which there is an acknowledged difficulty in the manipulation, half of these 20 plants had their fertility in some degree impaired. Moreover, as Gartner repeatedly crossed some forms, such as the common red and blue pimpernels, Anagallis arvensis and cerulea, which the best botanists rank as varieties, and found them absolutely sterile, we may doubt whether many species are really so sterile, when intercrossed, as he believed. It is certain, on the one hand, that the sterility of various species when crossed is so different in degree, and graduates away so insensibly, and, on the other hand, that the fertility of pure species is so easily affected by various circumstances, that for all practical purposes it is most difficult to say where perfect fertility ends and sterility begins. I think no better evidence of this can be required than that the two most experienced observers who have ever lived, namely Kohlreuther and Gartner, arrived at diametrically opposite conclusions in regard to some of the very same forms. It is also most instructive to compare, but I have not space here to enter on details, the evidence advanced by our best botanists on the question whether certain doubtful forms should be ranked as species or varieties, with the evidence from fertility adduced by different hybridizers, or by the same observer from experiments made during different years. It can thus be shown that neither sterility nor fertility affords any certain distinction between species and varieties. The evidence from this source graduates away, and is doubtful in the same degree as is the evidence derived from other constitutional and structural differences. In regard to the sterility of hybrids in successive generations, though Gartner was enabled to rear some hybrids, carefully guarding them from a cross with either pure parent, for 6 or 7 and in one case for 10 generations, yet he asserts positively that their fertility never increases, but generally decreases greatly and suddenly. With respect to this decrease, it may first be noticed that when any deviation in structure or constitution is common to both parents, this is often transmitted in an augmented degree to the offspring, and both sexual elements in hybrid plants are already affected in some degree. But I believe that their fertility has been diminished in nearly all these cases by an independent cause, namely by too close interbreeding. I have made so many experiments and collected so many facts, showing on the one hand that an occasional cross with a distinct individual or variety increases the vigor and fertility of the offspring, and on the other hand, that very close interbreeding lessens their vigor and fertility, that I cannot doubt the correctness of this conclusion. Hybrids are seldom raised by experimentalists in great numbers, and as the parent species, or other allied hybrids, generally grow in the same garden, the visits of insects must be carefully prevented during the flowering season. Hence hybrids, if left to themselves, will generally be fertilized during each generation by pollen from the same flower, and this would probably be injurious to their fertility, already lessened by their hybrid origin. I am strengthened in this conviction by a remarkable statement repeatedly made by Gartner, namely, that if even the less fertile hybrids be artificially fertilized with hybrid pollen of the same kind, their fertility, notwithstanding the frequent ill effects from manipulation, sometimes decidedly increases and goes on increasing. Now, in the process of artificial fertilization, pollen is as often taken by chance, as I know from my own experience, from the anthers of another flower as from the anthers of the flower itself which is to be fertilized. So that a cross between two flowers, though probably often on the same plant, would be thus effected. Moreover, whenever complicated experiments are in progress, so careful an observer as Gartner would have castrated his hybrids, and this would have ensured in each generation a cross with pollen from a distinct flower, either from the same plant or from another plant of the same hybrid nature. And thus the strange fact of an increase of fertility in the successive generations of artificially fertilized hybrids, in contrast with those spontaneously self-fertilized, may, as I believe, be accounted for by too close interbreeding having been avoided. Now let us turn to the results arrived at by a third most experienced hybridizer, namely the Honourable and Reverend W. Herbert. He is as emphatic in his conclusion that some hybrids are perfectly fertile as the pure parent species, as are Kohlreuter and Gartner that some degree of sterility between distinct species is a universal law of nature. He experimented on some of the very same species, as did Gartner. The difference in their results may, I think, be in part accounted for by Herbert's great horticultural skill, and by his having hothouses at his command. Of his many important statements, I will here give only a single one as an example, namely that every ovule in a pot of Crinum capense fertilized by Crinum revolutum produced a plant, which I never saw to occur in a case of its natural fecundation. So that here we have perfect, or even more than commonly perfect, fertility in a first cross between two distinct species. This case of the crinum leads me to refer to a singular fact, namely that individual plants of certain species of Lobelia, Verbascum, and Passiflora can easily be fertilized by the pollen from a distinct species, but not by pollen from the same plant, though this pollen can be proved to be perfectly sound by fertilizing other plants or species. In the genus Hippiastrum, in Corydalis, as shown by Professor Hildebrand, in various orchids, as shown by Mr. Scott and Fritz Müller, all the individuals are in this peculiar condition. So that with some species, certain abnormal individuals, and in other species all the individuals, can actually be hybridized much more readily than they can be fertilized by pollen from the same individual plant. To give one instance, a bulb of Hippiastrum aulicum produced 4 flowers. 3 were fertilized by Herbert with their own pollen, and the 4th was subsequently fertilized by the pollen of a compound hybrid descended from 3 distinct species. The result was that the ovaries of the 3 first flowers soon ceased to grow, and after a few days perished entirely, whereas the pod impregnated by the pollen of the hybrid made vigorous growth and rapid progress to maturity and bore good seed, which vegetated freely. Mr. Herbert tried similar experiments during many years, and always with the same result. These cases serve to show on what slight and mysterious causes the lesser or greater fertility of a species sometimes depends. The practical experiments of horticulturists, though not made with scientific precision, deserve some notice. It is notorious in how complicated a manner the species of Pelargonium, Fuchsia, Calceolaria, Petunia, Rhododendron, etc. have been crossed. Yet many of these hybrids seed freely. For instance, Herbert asserts that a hybrid from Calceolaria integrifolia and Plantaginia, species most widely dissimilar in general habit, reproduces itself as perfectly as if it had been a natural species from the mountains of Chile. I have taken some pains to ascertain the degree of fertility of some of the complex crosses of rhododendrons, and I am assured that many of them are perfectly fertile. Mr. C. Noble, for instance, informs me that he raises stocks for grafting from a hybrid between Rhododendron ponticum and Catawbiense, and this hybrid seeds as freely as it is possible to imagine. Had hybrids, when fairly treated, always gone on decreasing in fertility in each successive generation, as Gartner believed to be the case, the fact would have been notorious to nurserymen. Horticulturists raise large beds of the same hybrid, and such alone are fairly treated, for by insect agency the several individuals are allowed to cross freely with each other, and the injurious influence of close interbreeding is thus prevented. Anyone may readily convince himself of the efficiency of insect agency by examining the flowers of the more sterile kinds of hybrid rhododendrons, which produce no pollen, for he will find on their stigmas plenty of pollen brought from other flowers. In regard to animals, much fewer experiments have been carefully tried than with plants. If our systematic arrangements can be trusted, that is, if the genera of animals are as distinct from each other as are the genera of plants, then we may infer that animals more widely distinct in the scale of nature can be crossed more easily than in the case of plants. But the hybrids themselves are, I think, more sterile. It should, however, be borne in mind that, owing to few animals breeding freely under confinement, few experiments have been fairly tried. For instance, the canary bird has been crossed with 9 distinct species of finches, but, as not one of these breeds freely in confinement, we have no right to expect that the first crosses between them and the canary, or that of their hybrids, should be perfectly fertile. Again, with respect to the fertility in successive generations of the more fertile hybrid animals, I hardly know of an instance in which 2 families of the same hybrid have been raised at the same time from different parents, so as to avoid the ill effects of close interbreeding. On the contrary, brothers and sisters have usually been crossed in each successive generation, in opposition to the constantly repeated admonition of every breeder. And in this case, it is not at all surprising that the inherent sterility in the hybrids should have gone on increasing. Although I know of hardly any thoroughly well-authenticated cases of perfectly fertile hybrid animals, I have reason to believe that the hybrids from Savulus vaginalis and Reevesii, and from Phasianus colchicus with Phasianus torquatus, are perfectly fertile. Monsieur Quatrefages states that the hybrids from two moths, Bombyx cynthia and Arindia, were proved in Paris to be fertile inter se for 8 generations. It has lately been asserted that 2 such distinct species as the hare and the rabbit, when they can be got to breed together, produce offspring which are highly fertile when crossed with one of the parent species. The hybrids from the common and Chinese geese, Anser cygnoides, species which are so different that they are generally ranked in distinct genera, have often bred in this country with either pure parent, and in one single instance they have bred inter se. This was effected by Mr. Ayton, who raised 2 hybrids from the same parents, but from different hatches. And from these 2 birds he raised no less than 8 hybrids, grandchildren of the pure geese, from 1 nest. In India, however, these crossbred geese must be far more fertile, for I am assured by 2 eminently capable judges, namely Mr. Blythe and Captain Hutton, that whole flocks of these crossed geese are kept in various parts of the country. And as they are kept for profit where neither pure parent species exists, they must certainly be highly or perfectly fertile. With our domesticated animals, the various races, when crossed together, are quite fertile. Yet in many cases they are descended from 2 or more wild species. From this fact we must conclude either that the aboriginal parent species at first produced perfectly fertile hybrids, or that the hybrids subsequently reared under domestication became quite fertile. This latter alternative, which was first propounded by Pallas, seems by far the most probable, and can indeed hardly be doubted. It is, for instance, almost certain that our dogs are descended from several wild stocks. Yet, with perhaps the exception of certain indigenous domestic dogs of South America, all are quite fertile together. But analogy makes me greatly doubt whether the several aboriginal species would at first have freely bred together and have produced quite fertile hybrids. So again, I have lately acquired decisive evidence that the crossed offspring from the Indian humped and common cattle are, inter se, perfectly fertile. And from the observations by Rutimer on their important osteological differences, as well as from those by Mr. Blythe on their differences in habits, voice, constitution, etc., these 2 forms must be regarded as good and distinct species. The same remarks may be extended to the 2 chief races of the pig. We must, therefore, either give up the belief of the universal sterility of species when crossed, or we must look at this sterility in animals not as an indelible characteristic, but as one capable of being removed by domestication. Finally, considering all the ascertained facts on the intercrossing of plants and animals, it may be concluded that some degree of sterility, both in first crosses and in hybrids, is an extremely general result, but that it cannot, under our present state of knowledge, be considered as absolutely universal. Laws governing the sterility of first crosses and of hybrids. We will now consider a little more in detail the laws governing the sterility of first crosses and of hybrids. Our chief object will be to see whether or not these laws indicate that the species have been specially endowed with this quality in order to prevent their crossing and blending together in utter confusion. The following conclusions are drawn up chiefly from Gartner's admirable work on the hybridization of plants. I have taken much pains to ascertain how far they apply to animals, and considering how scanty our knowledge is in regard to hybrid animals, I have been surprised to find how generally the same rules apply to both kingdoms. It has been already remarked that the degree of fertility, both of first crosses and of hybrids, graduates from 0 to perfect fertility. It is surprising in how many curious ways this gradation can be shown. But only the barest outline of the facts can here be given. When pollen from a plant of one family is placed on the stigma of a plant of a distinct family, it exerts no more influence than so much inorganic dust. From this absolute zero of fertility, the pollen of different species applied to the stigma of some one species of the same genus yields a perfect gradation in the number of seeds produced up to nearly complete, or even quite complete, fertility. And as we have seen, in certain abnormal cases even to an excess of fertility beyond that which the plant's own pollen produces. So in hybrids themselves, there are some which never have produced, and probably never would produce, even with the pollen of the pure parents, a single fertile seed. But in some of these cases, a first trace of fertility may be detected by the pollen of one of the pure parent species causing the flower of the hybrid to wither earlier than it otherwise would have done. And the early withering of the flower is well known to be a sign of incipient fertilization. From this extreme degree of sterility, we have self-fertilized hybrids producing a greater and greater number of seeds up to perfect fertility. The hybrids raised from two species which are very difficult to cross and which rarely produce any offspring are generally very sterile. But the parallelism between the difficulty of making a first cross and the sterility of the hybrids thus produced, two classes of facts which are generally confounded together, is by no means strict. There are many cases in which two pure species, as in the genus Verbascum, can be united with unusual facility and produce numerous hybrid offspring. Yet these hybrids are remarkably sterile. On the other hand, there are species which can be crossed very rarely or with extreme difficulty, but the hybrids, when at last produced, are very fertile. Even within the limits of the same genus, for instance in Dianthus, these two opposite cases occur. The fertility both of first crosses and of hybrids is more easily affected by unfavourable conditions than is that of pure species. But the fertility of first crosses is likewise innately variable, for it is not always the same in degree when the same two species are crossed under the same circumstances. It depends in part upon the constitution of the individuals which happen to have been chosen for the experiment. So it is with hybrids, for their degree of fertility is often found to differ greatly in the several individuals raised from seed out of the same capsule and exposed to the same conditions. By the term systematic affinity is meant the general resemblance between species in structure and constitution. Now, the fertility of first crosses and of the hybrids produced from them is largely governed by their systematic affinity. This is clearly shown by hybrids never having been raised between species ranked by systematists in distinct families, and on the other hand, by very closely allied species generally uniting with facility. But the correspondence between systematic affinity and the facility of crossing is by no means strict. A multitude of cases could be given of very closely allied species which will not unite, or only with extreme difficulty, and on the other hand of very distinct species which unite with the utmost facility. In the same family there may be a genus, as Dianthus, in which very many species can most readily be crossed, and another genus, as Silene, in which the most persevering efforts have failed to produce between extremely close species a single hybrid. Even within the limits of the same genus, we meet with this same difference. For instance, the many species of Nicotiana have been more largely crossed than the species of almost any other genus. But Gartner found that Nicotiana acuminata, which is not a particularly distinct species, obstinately failed to fertilize, or to be fertilized, by no less than 8 other species of Nicotiana. Many analogous facts could be given. No one has been able to point out what kind or what amount of difference in any recognizable character is sufficient to prevent two species crossing. It can be shown that plants most widely different in habit and general appearance, and having strongly marked differences in every part of the flower, even in the pollen, in the fruit, and in the cotyledons can be crossed. Annual and perennial plants, deciduous and evergreen trees, plants inhabiting different stations and fitted for extremely different climates, can often be crossed with ease. By a reciprocal cross between two species, I mean the case, for instance, of a female ass being first crossed by a stallion and then a mare by a male ass. These two species may then be said to have been reciprocally crossed. There is often the widest possible difference in the facility of making reciprocal crosses. Such cases are highly important, but they prove that the capacity in any two species to cross is often completely independent of their systematic affinity, that is, of any difference in their structure or constitution, excepting in their reproductive systems. The diversity of the result in reciprocal crosses between the same two species was long ago observed by Kohlreuter. To give an instance, Mirabilis jalapa can easily be fertilized by the pollen of Mirabilis longiflora, and the hybrids thus produced are sufficiently fertile. But Kohlreuter tried more than 200 times during 8 following years to fertilize reciprocally Mirabilis longiflora with the pollen of Mirabilis jalapa, and utterly failed. Several other equally striking cases could be given. Thierry has observed the same fact with certain seaweeds or fuchi. Gartner, moreover, found that this difference of facility in making reciprocal crosses is extremely common in a lesser degree. He has observed it even between closely related forms, as Matiola annua and Glabra, which many botanists rank only as varieties. It is also a remarkable fact that hybrids raised from reciprocal crosses, though of course compounded of the very same two species, the one species having first been used as the father and then as the mother, though they rarely differ in external characters, yet generally differ in fertility in a small, and occasionally in a high, degree. Several other singular rules could be given from Gartner. For instance, some species have a remarkable power of crossing with other species. Other species of the same genus have a remarkable power of impressing their likeness on their hybrid offspring. But these two powers do not at all necessarily go together. There are certain hybrids which, instead of having, as is usual, an intermediate character between their two parents, always closely resemble one of them. And such hybrids, though externally so like one of their pure parent species, are, with rare exceptions, extremely sterile. So again, among hybrids which are usually intermediate in structure between their parents, exceptional and abnormal individuals sometimes are born, which closely resemble one of their pure parents. And these hybrids are almost always utterly sterile, even when the other hybrids, raised from seed from the same capsule, have a considerable degree of fertility. These facts show how completely the fertility of a hybrid may be independent of its external resemblance to either pure parent. Considering the several rules now given which govern the fertility of first crosses and of hybrids, we see that when forms which must be considered as good and distinct species are united, their fertility graduates from zero to perfect fertility, or even to fertility under certain conditions in excess. That their fertility, besides being eminently susceptible to favourable and unfavourable conditions, is innately variable. That it is by no means always the same in degree in the first cross and in the hybrids produced from this cross. That the fertility of hybrids is not related to the degree in which they resemble in external appearance either parent. And lastly, that the facility of making a first cross between any two species is not always governed by their systematic affinity or degree of resemblance to each other. This latter statement is clearly proved by the difference in the result of reciprocal crosses between the same two species, for, according as the one species or the other is used as the father or the mother, there is generally some difference, and occasionally the widest possible difference, in the facility of effecting an union. The hybrids, moreover, produced from reciprocal crosses often differ in fertility. Now, do these complex and singular rules indicate that species have been endowed with sterility simply to prevent their becoming confounded in nature? I think not. For why should the sterility be so extremely different in degree when various species are crossed, all of which we must suppose it would be equally important to keep from blending together? Why should the degree of sterility be innately